get this straight. If the indictment is, and I have seen you say this, that crossfire reduces everything, as I said in the intro, to left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left.
Stop.
Why do we have to fight?
Why do you argue?
We're in bad shape, fellas.
We need help from the media, and they're hurting us. You're doing theater when you should be doing debate.
You're listening to Under Surveillance, WLEW's biweekly show on popular culture, politics, and the relationship between mass media and public opinion. I'm your host, Kevin Fulham, and every second and fourth Wednesday mornings, I'll be joined by a series of guests as we take a look at everything from the makeup of the Supreme Court to upcoming elections and to how social and political climates impact our view of the future in film and television. Under Surveillance is broadcast on WLEW, a listener-supported community radio. And for more information or to listen to archive shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. The issue of net neutrality has been attracting a great deal of attention from both the press and Congress in recent weeks. What exactly are we talking about when we use the term net neutrality? Is this a question of corporations possibly gaining the power to stamp out free speech on the web? Or is this really a matter of big companies versus other big companies over future internet-based streams of revenue? What are the implications of the legislation being debated in Congress? My guest will be Mitchell Shapinchik of Chicago Media Action. Net neutrality, up next on Under Surveillance. Welcome to another edition of Under Surveillance here at WLUW. My name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm happy to be joined today by Mitchell Shapinchik.
Shapinchik. There you go.
He's with Chicago Media Action, and we're talking today about the issue of net neutrality. Issue that's being highly debated right now in Congress. It's received a lot of press attention over the last month or so. So, Mitchell, why don't you tell me a little bit more, just defining in layman's terms, what the issue of net neutrality means?
Mm-hmm. I like to think of it in terms of being the First Amendment of the internet. It basically says that those who control the various pipelines by which internet traffic flows, and basically internet service providers large and small, don't discriminate or give preferential treatment for or against any content. They don't discriminate. And I like to think of it in terms of freedom of speech issues of the First Amendment of the internet. And that's basically simply all that it is. And it's something of a bone of contention because major phone and cable interests, some of the major companies in the United States, in fact, want to basically allow for preferential treatment of their own content at the expense of content of those who are outside of their own select circle. But there could be a catch. If you wanted to have a content that's not in their select circle, you could pay for that privilege. And that would mean that they would be able to have a lot of money more so. So this could be seen basically as drawing the carrot to try to allow Congress to set up laws to allow companies to extort on the internet, is what this basically could be interpreted as boiling down to. But it's a serious debate that's been raging, well, for the last year or so. There's been echoes of the issue coming up back and forth in recent years, but the issue really crystallized in the summer of 2005 when the Supreme Court ruled on a ruling that didn't get a whole lot of attention, but which could prove very influential as far as the future of the media in the United States. It's called the Brand X case, where an internet service provider in California called Brand X sued the Federal Communications Commission over FCC policies involving discrimination of internet content. And Brand X wound up losing that case. And as a result, that policy opened the door for further laws that could allow for future discrimination of content. And that's basically what's raging in Congress now and has been basically for the last, well, since the beginning of calendar year 2006, really. It's really taken off since March 2006 and really immensely so and certainly in the past month, in June 2006. But that's basically what the issue lies here. On the one hand, you see a small number of phone and cable companies, companies like AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, Bell South, Quest, Sprint, and others. A small number of companies who basically would want to turn the internet into their own cash cow. And on the other side, practically everyone else who is not aligned with this. Coalitions of groups from all across the political spectrum who have aligned in various groups, certain technical issues, local and state governments, all who have been involved in various efforts to try to keep the internet basically the free medium that, for the most part, it currently is. Whether or not it will stay that way is the debate that's currently raging in Congress right now.
Okay, well, we're going to get to the issue of discriminatory practices in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But first of all, so what's happening right now in terms of Congress? And there's a recent amendment that was attempted to be tacked on to a bill regarding this issue. So why don't you speak a little bit more about that?
A little bit of background first. The House has already voted to kill the Internet. They have approved a very controversial bill, the Communications Opportunity Promotion and Enhancement Act, which was originally co-sponsored by 1st District of Illinois' very own Bobby Rush, who was my representative for 8 years, it turns out. He co-sponsored the original bill, was the first Democratic co-sponsor of the bill. And it basically went through the motions in various House committees and was approved on June 8th. And so now that law, which would amend the current Telecommunications Act, the main law concerning internet and the media in the United States, is now amended in the House to basically allow these major companies I just mentioned earlier to run roughshod over the internet and basically ruin the internet for everyone else. Well, it's already approved in the House. The Senate is now where the terrain of battle now lies. The Senate Commerce Committee on June 22nd had voted to take a huge bill, much larger actually than the COPE Act, with a lot of provisions beyond just net neutrality. Ted Stevens of Alaska, a Republican senator from Alaska, had been pushing this huge bill with huge impacts, never mind just the internet, on the issue. And a number of amendments were approved to that, one of which proposed was network neutrality, which wound up losing by a tie vote. Of the 22 members who had voted on the issue, it came up 11 to 11, split almost entirely along party lines, but not exclusively so. We had one Republican who had co-sponsored the network neutrality amendment. And as a result of that, it turns out that ties wind up making any amendments as losses. And so as a result, it wasn't included on this huge omnibus bill. And whether or not that bill actually will come up for a vote in the main Senate, where it actually would need to be approved, is something of an open question. And in fact, Bill Frist, the Senate Majority Leader, who basically has a call as far as allowing any votes of any bills to come up for a vote, has basically said, this is a really contentious issue. A lot of people have chimed in on this, and frankly, I don't know if we have the time or the resources to be able to devote pushing this through in 2006. And he has said only if you know that you can guarantee enough votes to be able to prevent any blocks. As a filibuster has actually been proposed. Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon, senator there, has actually said this issue of network neutrality and the future of the internet is too important. I'm going to call a filibuster if it turns out this bill comes to a vote. And Bill Frist has basically said, I'm not even going to even allow this bill to come up for a vote unless I know that there are at least the necessary 60 votes to kill off that filibuster in advance. And so now it's basically becoming this chess game of whether or not this bill involving the internet and, by extension, the future of the media will even come up for a vote. I'm personally hoping, at least as a short-term remedy, that it doesn't, because that would mean that any legislation that would get approved would get rolled back to the beginning with the new Congress in 2007. And a number of analysts are saying that that could well be a Democratic Congress, which would bode at least a little better for this issue. Not exclusively so. I mean, we've seen Democrats who have signed on to this issue in the negative. And I'm hoping that more Democrats could sign on in the positive. And that's an issue, I think, not just for insiders in Washington, but also for everyday people to get involved with, because it affects them seriously, well, certainly if they use the internet, and increasingly in other media that they'll use.
Okay. Well, you mentioned some very strong terms before earlier on, that this would kill the internet, you mm-hmm. said. How so?
Well, I like to provide the metaphor of providing toll roads on the internet. Think of the internet as a road or a freeway or a set of freeways where you can basically go to anywhere you want if you know where to go and if other people can provide means of getting there. If you know where to go and you know how to get there, there's nothing stopping your way. I mean, obviously there are going to be costs involved of, you know, you have to buy a computer, you have to buy internet access. If you want to set up a website, you have to set up the nominal cost for a website. But beyond that, it's your call. The control is that of the end user and ultimately the producer. And that's actually made the internet the vibrant medium that it currently stands as now. If the current version of the Senate bill goes through as passed, that would mean that suddenly these internet service providers would be able to set up these toll roads where if you wanted to view a website that, let's say here broadcasting out of WLUW studios, say mm-hmm. you wanted to go to WLUW.org. If it turns out that WLUW is not aligned with any of the internet service providers for whom you're accessing the internet, you may have to pay a fee as an end user. Moreover, WLUW, to access internet customers outside of whatever internet service it winds up using as its internet service provider may also have to pay a fee to whoever winds up providing that access. Suddenly, the costs for access, not only for accessing content, but for also providing content, are suddenly raised tremendously high. And if you don't have that money, obviously that's going to be a big deterrence to accessing that content or providing that content.
But really, with the argument that we're talking about here has really come into play due to the fact that video, streaming video over the web, is something that's going to explode in the coming years. Because in terms of the competition for bandwidth, because the amount of bandwidth that it takes to pop up a web page, you know, on the internet is minuscule as opposed to the bandwidth in terms of, providing some kind of, video program, some television program or movie over the internet. And also, talking about the legislation going through Congress, well, right now, the legislation would change the way that companies are able to practice what you would say would be discriminatory practices as far as web access. They can do these things right now, but they're not.
Right. You can certainly separate out the issue of video on the internet, which is going to be the trajectory that everyone who is going to access video, be it television, a home movie that you post on the website, or what have you, that's going to be the trajectory, especially since Congress has already signed and the White House has approved into law legislation to basically kill over-the-air analog television broadcasting in February 2009. That's the date. If you don't have a TV set that's digital capable or that has a converter box, your TV set will go dark on that date. It's already sailed into law. It's now a question of what happens next. And one obvious convergence will be digital television. And how will that wind up being transferred? Well, the internet is going to be the main backbone for that. However, it's to be said that other countries around the world are and in fact already have in many cases deployed speeds that far already dwarf that which a lot of these phone companies, for example, are proposing to set up as their high end are already not only in place now, but at speeds far in excess of what's available now. To mention a specific example, AT&T wants to set up a controversial video service, basically their version of cable, and they're calling it Project Lightspeed. And in fact, they've been trying to deploy it, forcing it down in at least 6 city suburbs in the city of Chicago. They've been trying to deploy this on a suburb-by-suburb basis. A number of suburbs have basically saying, hold on. You need to go through us because this is a public service you're providing to our communities, and we want to be able to have a say on this because these are our communities and we should have a say and do similar negotiations with cable companies as far as how this goes. AT&T has basically responded by suing 6 of those suburbs by basically saying, no, we are not cable companies, we are phone companies, therefore you have no say in blocking us in providing this service that we want to provide. That Project Lightspeed service would provide in the ballpark of something like 4 to 6 megabits per second of video. By way of comparison, a country like South Korea, which up until this year had been the leader as far as broadband penetration and broadband access and speeds of internet capability for which you could provide extraordinarily fast internet service to the wide variety of the population, South Korea already has widely available and cheaply available speeds upwards in excess of 100 megabits per second, far in excess for what AT&T is proposing now in just an experimental stage, far cheaply and with strong network neutrality provisions in place. In a number of countries that you're finding this kind of access or proposed access, or not even just proposed, in many places it's already accessible, you are already seeing extraordinary high speeds, fairly low cost, wide access to a great majority of the population to make it a publicly available resource like electricity or water. The internet should be a similarly a publicly available resource, as it's seen in many countries, and with strong network neutrality provisions in play. And it's only here in the United States where you're basically seeing this stingy attitude of barely any access for just the barest minimum for which you actually need video, and with abolishing any kind of network neutrality provisions where basically a small handful of companies would pick and choose what content they want or don't want or would prefer and basically allow everyone else to the proverbial internet dirt road.
Okay, but now this is also an entirely another argument where you're talking about the countries or governments that you are in favor of taking over these kinds of industries as opposed to AT&T, Verizon, other companies who have laid out the investments. I mean, there are a couple of issues that I want to get to here. First of all is the issue of preferential treatment. When you go on Yahoo Yellow Pages and you click, okay, I want Chinese restaurants,
right?
Companies that pay money are going to be listed at the top. They're going to be listed in gold before you get to alphabetical order based on your zip code you're in, companies that pay money get preferential treatment. Companies that pay money on Google, if I put in laptops, there are going to be banners there from companies who advertise to make sure that they are given featured treatment. And if I want to buy a laptop, well, you know, they're popping up right on that first page.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So why is a company like Google or a company like Yahoo, they're able to do the same thing with their customers. So why are you saying that internet companies, the phone companies, cable companies, should not be allowed to do that with people who want to access the internet?
Actually, I am saying that they should not be allowed to do that kind of preferential treatment precisely because they already get extraordinary preferential treatment in terms of monopoly franchise rights, basically awarded to them through, in the case of the cable companies, they're awarded monopoly franchise rights. And like, never mind some kind of myth about a competitive market. They're it. They're given a monopoly basically by whatever the local government is that they're negotiating with. As far as, now that's an extraordinary huge preferential treatment. But that's basically a license for them to print money, essentially. And that means that they'll be able to provide video internet access. In the case of Comcast, you can even provide long distance phone service already via cable lines. And they basically are just taking this extraordinary largesse that they already are given for nominal requirements back, sometimes even free. And suddenly they're pleading poverty and pleading, oh, you're not letting us have this. It's not fair. We're not being allowed to be in this competitive market. You've been awarded the winner from day one on the course of this. This is a spurious argument that these telcos are providing.
So
they're trying to plead poverty in this regard for providing this access for which other companies, actually, like Google and Yahoo and others, no doubt they're providing a business and they're doing that course of action. But nonetheless, no one is stopping me, for example, to put up some other website that could rival them and provide some other metric by which other people could access my own Yellow Pages, let's say. Mitchell's Yellow Pages, just for lack of a sake of an argument. Yeah. I could put that up. It would certainly be out there with Google, with Yahoo, with whoever else would want it. The issue is not so much a matter of business models as it is a matter of control. Who calls the controls as far as the end shots of what's available here? Is it the telcos who would basically want to control things for their own increasing pocket concerns? Or is it end users who want to basically allow for free access and a diversity of choices for quality internet experience? That's the question here, I think.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and I'm joined here by Mitchell
Stepinchik. Very good.
And he's with Chicago Media Action, and we're talking all about issues involving net neutrality. It's certainly an issue that's gotten a lot of press over the last month or so, and there's a lot of legislation being bandied about in Congress right now in terms of the possibility of putting restraints or at least making sure that companies like AT&T and Verizon and companies that offer internet access. The argument on the net neutrality side is that they should provide the same type of access to the same websites at the same speeds without any kind of additional charge or any special charge to people who don't pay tolls to those giant companies. We're getting back to the issue of preferential treatment. There's no such legislation in place preventing companies from doing that kind of thing right now. I mean,
that's correct.
Right? We'll say go back to 1995 or 1996, where a lot of people were using America Online.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And America Online had their own news section, their own sports, their own finance.
That's right.
So America Online, if they wanted to, could say, okay, if you're interested in sports, you can't go to ESPN.com. You've got to go to AOL Sports.
Mm-hmm.
They could have done that.
Yeah.
But they didn't.
They didn't precisely because there had been developments involving the technical infrastructure of the internet that allowed people to have a wider variety of choices. That was ultimately built on policy decisions that basically said the internet is this neutral medium that anyone who wants to set up something, if they can provide the technical infrastructure to access it, can access it.
Well,
it's not. I mean, there's questions regarding the technical ability of being able to access it, and also a political question involved in this.
But you don't think that part of the decision to allow that is because of the fact that, well, if a consumer accessed AOL and wasn't able to get ESPN.com, then they would use another service. You don't think that entered the equation at all? That, okay, if we don't allow our users access to these kinds of websites, they're going to bail and go somewhere else.
For a long time, that actually had been the model for the internet. Around 1992, if you wanted to access the internet, usually you did so from some paid service like Prodigy or CompuServe, America Online. You can mention a number of others. They basically were company websites. That the content there was provided by the company. You could access it. You could maybe even contribute to it. Maybe send some emails back and forth. They'd have some chat boards. But if you wanted to try to access things beyond that company internet, and which wasn't even an internet, a lot of the kind of innovations that actually wound up coming later that wound up blowing that commercial model out of the water because they provided a lot more content, a lot more cheaply otherwise. That was the model for a long time, which had been changed precisely because other people, in fact, right here in Illinois, downstate at the University of Illinois, Mark Andreessen, had built a browser to access what was then the World Wide Web, which was also the number two server. The first server was in Geneva, Switzerland, for the World Wide Web. Number two was here in Illinois, in Batavia, in Fermilab, in fact. That's where the second World Wide Web server was. You logged in, the password was www, write that down, folks, and you can access the World Wide Web. Now, that wasn't a terribly user-friendly model of it. And that's what the innovation came downstate from, with Mark Andreessen inventing a web browser, which was itself an innovation, a graphical interface for this new invention that allowed for extraordinary access in a very user-friendly format that then a lot of people could then contribute to and use this tool to be able to access this content that it's now suddenly all these companies that basically had the game to themselves are now finding themselves with the short end of the stick on this count. And suddenly now, in fact, a lot of these companies, they're still around, but are the pale shadow of what they had once been. They had been the internet for a long time. Now they're basically another proverbial lemonade stand in the corner where there's this huge, diverse bazaar of options available.
So isn't that the solution then? The more options that are available to the consumer, then in terms of checks and balances, you know, that's going to prevent any one company from saying, okay, you can go here, you can't go there, otherwise you're going to have to pay me.
In the short term as a business model, precisely. And that's exactly why I and a number of others have been advocating for a network neutrality approach on this count. Precisely because...
Okay, it seems like kind of the opposite of what we're talking
about.
On
the contrary, no. It means if you or anyone else came up with some bright idea that you wanted to share with the world, currently you can. And you can do so for a nominal cost. You don't have to be well-heeled or have $70,000 in your couch to buy the resources necessary to be able to pull this off. You have got a great idea, the willing to work on it, and some nominal amount of fee just to help to pay for the necessary economic costs for this. You can do that. And it's a policy question about whether or not that can happen, beyond just never mind the coming up with a great idea, knowing how to program, being sure you can pay up with your electricity to be able to power the computer to do this. All this stuff are certainly necessary, but they're not alone sufficient. That's where the politics question of this comes in as well. And that's why it's a big power play right now raging in Congress, and which is exactly why, even though it sounds contradictory, it's a policy question of whether or not these open realms of free speech can be allowed to flourish. And that's why it's a political question, ultimately, that each of us needs to decide on our own.
Well, I think it sounds a little contradictory because we have two separate arguments going on here. One argument is in terms of access, whether someone can actually access website X or website Y without paying more money. The other argument, we're talking about higher speeds, which people like AT&T or Verizon, companies like that, are in favor of. And that if you pay us more money, then we're going to make sure that if you have content that's very... I don't even have a term for it. I don't know if you could say broadband heavy or... then you're going to have to pay us more money in order to enable the user to access that information. But if it's something like a website or text or a commentary or a blog, you know, it's not really going to matter what your connection speed is, right?
The contradiction seems apparent because, obviously, if you're going to need more access, you're going to pay for more access. There's no argument there. No one's arguing otherwise. It's a matter of... whether or not that access is allowed by those internet service providers, a matter of control with regards to, and that's actually what I had said from the very beginning about defining it, going back to the very definition of what network neutrality is, which has a definition despite what the telcos would want you to believe. Very clear definition. Those who are in provide the internet service providers, don't discriminate as far as that content, where it goes, who's sending it, or why. If you have to pay more to get more access, certainly. And in fact, the economics of it have been such that rather than it being a matter of scarcity, where you need to pay so much more to get so much more, it's been exactly the opposite. You've actually been, costs have been coming down as speeds have been ramping up and access has been ramping up. The economics of it are trying to be skewed in order to provide the supposed scarcity argument. Ultimately, though, it's a political question. Who has control? Is it the end user or is it the internet service provider? And for what ends? Is it the internet service provider to line their pockets, or is it community or individual who wants to do some real solid work or innovation or what have you to share with the world and that others can access readily, cheaply, efficiently, and all of that?
But aren't the companies on the other side of this argument going to line their pockets as well, too? Companies like Google, companies like Yahoo.
In fact, they have. And in fact, that's actually one reason why I suspect that the main phone and cable companies have actually been trying to push to try to get network neutrality abolished. Take Google, for example. Huge company, very celebrated initial public offering, hundreds of billions of dollars in traffic, stock is going through the roof. And that is ultimately built, ironically enough, on the kind of infrastructure that companies like AT&T and Verizon and Comcast provide. The thing, though, is that while Google and Yahoo and all of these internet content providers have had their stocks and have had huge revenues, these other internet service provider companies, the phone and cable companies, have seen their revenues not at scale up to that level, in fact, and they've actually been relatively flat. And where they've got a mandate being corporate entities to try to squeeze as much money as possible, well, there's more money that they could squeeze out. And so that's why it's been something of a turf battle among other players, with not only the phone and cable companies on one side, but internet content providers like eBay and Amazon.com and Google and Yahoo and all of these, and even like far smaller providers like my group ChicagoMediaAction.org. We rent space in an internet service provider here on the north side to provide our website. And we're able to do that for a cost of probably under $100 a year. And anyone can. I mean, never mind just some small nonprofit group. But that's an issue of the eBay and Amazon and Google versus the AT&Ts and Verizons. Basically, who is able to ultimately score the most money in the end, or even in the short term? I mean, there are some signs that you could be reverted back to the days of a sparse corporate internet back in the, you know, in 1992, where you had three companies providing all the content that you could only access if you happened to be a subscriber of those companies. We could be returning to those bad old days, perhaps to their detriment, because then they have to provide that content, have to pay for that content, and other people would not be allowed to or even permitted to, even when it may actually prove them ultimately beneficial later on.
You think we'd really go back to that kind of an environment?
That's what a real risk here is, I fear.
But I think, you know, as soon as one...
I mean, I'd be happy to be proved wrong, but I'm just very afraid of this.
But don't you think as soon as one company does this, then their business is going to shatter? I mean, all the people who are going to subscribe to that business would move on.
Where would they move on to?
To another company.
But the problem there is that infrastructure is not going to be rebuilt. You're not going to see another internet that's going to be rebuilt elsewhere that somebody else... It's like, okay, suppose that...
Take wireless, for example.
Which is also increasingly being cornered by these same companies. I mean, like, that's an interesting power play in and of itself that we could talk another half hour about, which may prove to be an interesting monkey wrench in the gears of this entire operation that these major telco and cable companies want to try to provide. So, yeah, there are some other factors here as well and might prove to be an issue there. But consider this. For about 98% of Americans, the only options they have available are the monopoly phone company and the monopoly cable company and nothing else. No one else is going to build another internet or intranet infrastructure. It's not like you can go anyplace else. This is it. And which is why I think this fight is so hugely important. If we don't win this fight, and I think this fight could be determined one way or the other, perhaps in the next 3 months, or maybe in the next month, who knows. Certainly within calendar year 2006, one way or the other, we may know the future of the internet for better or worse. Where it goes ultimately is a question for each of us to get involved with. I can plug some other resources that are working on this issue.
Sure, please do.
Probably the biggest initiative is one called SaveTheInternet.com, a coalition of more than 700 groups, including that of Chicago Media Action, that have come together from across the political spectrum, from all walks of life, to create a coalition effort to basically encourage Congress to keep the internet as neutral as it is. SaveTheInternet.com, ChicagoMediaAction.org has been doing local efforts. I'd encourage people to get involved.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you've been listening to Under Surveillance here on WLUW, and my guest has been Mitchell Stepinchik.
Got it.
All right.
10 points.
And again, he's with Chicago Media Action. They're located at chicagomediaaction.org. Thank you very much, Mitchell, for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
You've been listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW, and for more information or to listen to archived shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. That's www.undersurveillance.org.